Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Jesuit Refugee Service marks 30 years of accompaniment to people on the move. Hear from the former international director, Father Mark Raper. And meeting God in friend and stranger, how Catholics in England and Wales are putting into practice the principles of interfaith dialogue spelt out in a recent publication from the Bishops' Conference. Moved by the plight of the Vietnamese boat people and refugees from the Horn of Africa in the late 1970s, former Jesuit Superior General Father Pedro Arrupe founded a network to respond to their urgent needs and to make their voice heard at international level. Thus, the Jesuit Refugee Service was born in November 1980 to put into practice the Society of Jesus principle of faith doing justice wherever the greatest needs are found. 3 decades on, JRS is working in nearly 60 countries across the globe, serving 500,000 refugees and internally displaced people of many different races, ethnic origins and religious beliefs. Listening closely to the refugees themselves, its goals are to provide education, health and other relief services, as well as addressing the root causes of poverty and displacement.
Their mission is threefold: to accompany, to serve the people, and to defend their rights.
Jesuit Father Mark Raper was involved in the JRS from its earliest days and served for 10 years as its international director here in Rome. Today he lives in the Philippines, where he works as president of the Jesuit Conference of the Asia-Pacific region. Yet wherever he travels around the world, he never misses an opportunity to catch up with former refugees or migrants who've helped to shape his work and the mission of the Jesuit Refugee Service. Father Mark Raper, thank you for joining us in studio today.
Thank you.
Let's just look back a moment to the origins. How did it all begin? Where did the idea come from?
The idea grew out of three things that came together for Father Arrupe. First, he was very strongly moved by the plight of the refugees, by what he saw. He felt he not only wanted to do something, he had to do something. It was his duty.
At that time, it was the Vietnamese refugees.
Vietnamese boat people,
it?
Especially, which was hitting the news. But also, the Horn of Africa was very strong, experienced Somalia and Sudan. And then, secondly, it was the end of the 70s. So it was the time of trying to put into place a very strong commitment the Jesuits had taken for a faith that does justice. And to tell you the truth, looking back, it probably wasn't working well. You know, it was still, like a lot of Jesuit things, at an intellectual level. So here was another methodology, here was another approach. And thirdly, there was the realization that many other people were also very moved by this and would join with us if we gave them the means. And we had the means in a global body with very good communications right around the world. So we could give people this network, access to this network, to get their contribution to where it was needed.
You're talking about refugees, methodology and partnerships, in
yes.
essence. These are the three
yes.
guiding principles
yes.
30 years on as well,
yes.
aren't they?
Yes, it's the inspiration that comes from the refugees. You know, it's a classic organizational theory that your structure should be set up according to what your mission is, not the other way around. And so many times within the church we have the institutions and they have to be preserved, but that's not what it's about. The thing is that the institutions have to change to serve the mission. And here was a very compelling mission which enabled us to structure in a way to support that. So the spirit, if you like, the way we were informed, and in fact, you know, I was just set to work almost without any instructions as regional director for Asia Pacific, and we just learnt from our experience. Each program on the ground was shaped from what the needs of the refugees were and what our resources were and how we could work. And the organization, now it's in practically 60 countries and 10 regional offices, each autonomous, and a very strong spirit, but also reasonably strong structure. But it still has this flexibility. They've recently opened in Syria. You know, they're developing a Middle East program, and it's totally different way of working on the ground, because you're in amongst Shiite, Sunni people who have great suspicion for a Christian body. But nonetheless, when we live with the refugees, when they see that we love them, a lot of things become possible.
When you started back then, as you say, it must have been a huge challenge for you. What was your personal motivation? What kept you going despite these enormous challenges?
Well, looking back, of course, you see, my God, that was a challenge. But when you're in the middle of it, you do what you can. You know, it's one by one. And the beauty of this service, I think, is that it concentrates on individuals and at the same time tries to see the whole picture. Just starting wherever we are, helping one, two, three people, we realize what are the needs of 10 or 100. And with that, we realize what are the needs of thousands. And being close to the people, we learn a lot. So that way we can shape a program which helps a tremendous number of people on the ground, but also responds to the yearning of many people elsewhere. You know, the church is in crisis today because whenever it doesn't listen to people's longings, to people's yearnings, and the refugees are somehow allowed to go to the edge, allowed to be unheard, allowed to be just forgotten. And there are a lot of people who are upset by that, but don't know what to do. So Pedro Arrupe put this Jesuit refugee service as a tool in between the needs of people, a switchboard, he called it, between identified needs and the desire of people to help. And that's the task, just to connect.
This as really a pioneering idea that is still as effective today as it was 30 years ago?
I think he was right at the beginning of a realization of the global nature of the world and of the church. You could see his idea growing. When he was upset by the refugee situation that he saw, he sent a cable to 20 provincials, 20 Jesuits in key leadership positions around the world. And he was amazed by the response he got. We have a hospital, we can send a team, we have resources, we can send this person who has experience. And so he thought, my God, look at our capacity. So, you know, we keep saying we're universal, we keep saying we're worldwide and all of that. But until then, I think he realized we'd never used that supranational capacity properly. And so this structure he set in place, of course, has only grown in potential with the increase in capacity of communications, the mobility, the flexibility that's possible today in terms of transport and contact with people.
You're talking about a mission based on listening to individuals. You've met some extraordinary individuals in your time, haven't you? Can you remember perhaps back to the first people who really...
Can I remember? I can't forget. The very first camp I went to was Pulau Galang in Indonesia. Not the first camp I'd visited, but the first one I'd visited once I was given this job. I arrived in this camp, and the pastor there, it was a camp of 20 or 30,000 people, he said, oh, good, I can go and make my retreat. So he hopped on the boat I'd arrived on and left me there, and I met this woman who had made the journey, and on the journey, two of her children had died and her sister. And just she and the boat captain remained alive. And she blamed the boat captain because he hadn't given food and water to her family. So she wanted to kill him. She wanted to take revenge. And she was consumed by revenge for months. And she used to talk to the priest there, an Italian Jesuit. But one day she came and she said, I want to forgive him. And so they arranged in the front of everybody a whole gathering, actually in the church, even though they weren't not so many of the people were Christians, but many came, you know, they're Buddhists, so they come to because they have that depth of spirituality. And in front of everybody, she forgave him. She said, "I forgive you." And you could see the change in him, the change in her, the change in the whole camp, because every refugee has done something of which they feel guilty. They've left their parents. They've left their future. They've left their education that their parents had planned for them. They've left the graves of their ancestors. They've taken things along the way to survive. They've left their country, and they didn't want to do it. And this possibility of forgiveness was an amazing thing, just to see it change the atmosphere of the camp. Refugee populations, they're neither east nor west, they're people traversing cultures also. They're facing enormous personal change. But often refugees are themselves former something and not yet something. They cling to their traditions more than most, I suppose, in order to preserve some identity. And they can become very conservative like that as they keep as groups, but they have to undergo immense, immense change themselves.
Father Arupe, back at the beginning there, was very moved by the plight of the refugees he saw, and yet today the situation has become even more complex. There are more refugees today than ever before, aren't there?
Yes. You know, we work, a Jesuit Refugee Service works in a field where it's with agencies like the United Nations. It has a very strict mandate, obviously, so that they can focus their work. And the Refugee Service has to focus. But it's a focus more in terms of urgency. You know, what is the greatest need? These actually criteria come from the Jesuit Constitution. Where can you do the greatest good? Who has the greatest need? And where is there a lack of other people for this service? So now I've returned to Asia Pacific, where I worked in the 80s. We never had the term internally displaced people. And it became part of the parlance, and it's also the fact that so many refugees, victims of conflict, are not able to leave their country. There's a greater inhospitality, greater refusal now to receive refugees. So many remain within their own country and still at risk, displaced in southern Philippines, for example, inside Burma. So we've got that. We've got stateless people. We've got maybe 3 million stateless people in Thailand. We didn't have these concepts even. But now you have climate change refugees, or at least people displaced by the crises, millions still homeless in Pakistan from the floods, the volcanoes or tsunamis or landslides, mudslides, and typhoons and cyclones, especially in Asia with the coastal estuarial cities, poorly developed, poor planning, poor development. The world population's gone from 4.4 billion in 1980 now to almost 7. So there are fewer places for refugees to go. And you have undocumented migrants, you have trafficked women and children. So these criteria of the refugee service to assist those in greatest need has to include a broader range of people. So they've got quite a challenge as an organization to refocus themselves.
You're painting quite a bleak picture of a situation that seems to see no solution, a refugee population that will continue to grow, needs that continue to grow.
Well, I'm sorry to paint it so bleakly like that. I suppose I am pointing precisely to the problems of people who are not heard or people who are on the margins. At the same time, the hope arises from the fact that there is a body like this refugee service, like the Caritas agencies, like the many different groups who respond and who help to identify what would be appropriate policies. Their mission is threefold: to accompany listen to it, to serve the people, and to defend their rights. And they become, because of their experience, become quite articulate about policy, about appropriate policy, about what can serve best people, what arrangements of government, because sometimes governments are a bit lost. They're not in contact so much with the real needs. And the refugee services had some great, you could say, great achievements. They have an office close to the European Parliament. They have a strong office in Washington and Geneva also. And they were so active in the campaign against landmines and then the cluster munitions. These are successful campaigns which they've worked on solidly. And I think that the point of hope that I see is that here's a body that can get the voice and the experience of people who are otherwise neglected into these fora, into these places where decisions are made.
These are small successes you're talking about on a broader scale. As you say, countries are increasingly less willing to take refugees. We talk about Fortress Europe closing down the gates, not wanting to take refugees in numbers that have been taken in the past.
Yeah, and Europe suffers from that. You know, the countries that refuse to change, they suffer economically. These are countries which are aging. And now you see in France the objection to raising the retirement age, but they have to do these things because they don't have the labor force contributing to their superannuation funds and whatever. But if they received the greater number of immigrants, they would have the labor force. But that involves a change which is not always desired, a change of culture, a change of milieu, a change of languages, a change from a monocultural society to a multicultural society, and that's a very difficult thing to face. That requires a lot of leadership and a lot of thought. We take the benefits of the globalization and the transfer of money and wealth and all of that, but we don't take the other aspects of it, which really should run together. And we would long for politicians who would give real leadership about how we can live together much more harmoniously. And I think leadership is a big key to that.
It's also about public awareness, isn't it? And,
yes.
And getting the story yes. out, as you
yes.
say. How can we do that more effectively?
You do it very well indeed. And I think it is the mission of the church. You know, the church is a worldwide network of communities, you could say, a worldwide community. And the refugees are the other side of that. They're a worldwide feature of people pushed out of communities. So the welcoming role that the church plays in every place is a real match. It's the other half of the picture to the refugee problem. It matches the human need and the spiritual longing of people.
I'm going to ask you for one more story, perhaps, of people, the ones that have perhaps affected you most in this work that you've done.
I told a story last night about a Sudanese man, a Dinka, who I met in Thailand. This man had left home in 1983. He'd gone to Egypt from the Sudan. They could travel at that time easily to Egypt. He got to Iraq and got caught up. He was engaged for 3 years, I think it was, in the Iran-Iraq War of the 80s. Once he was released from that, he tried to get to Europe. He couldn't, was refused. He went to Singapore, and they sent him to Thailand. And that's where I met him, very lonely, very disoriented. We tried and tried to get him to some country, Australia, Canada, USA, Scandinavian countries, and they all refused. But the UN, there's a lady there who was very kind to him and very helpful, but finally offered to go home to Sudan, to go to Kenya or to go to Liberia. He chose Liberia, and he arrived there in 1988. It was a peaceful country, strong care by the United States. But after the Berlin Wall fell, the United States wasn't interested in Liberia anymore, and Charles Taylor's revolution, you know, his attempt to take power, began Christmas Eve 1989, just after the whole world changed. So years later, I was in Rome, or not much later, 1990, I went to start my job in Rome, and I went to Liberia to see what we could do. We started a program, and we've only just finished it, actually. We worked there for years in Liberia. And I looked for Gabriel as well, for this man. And I found a Salesian father, Scottish Salesian father, who'd looked after him and helped him. And he told me how he'd been killed by one of Charles Taylor's followers. As he was shot, he was holding in his arms, in his hand, big, long, tall man, long arms. He was holding the card which said he was under the protection of the United Nations. And I was immensely sad because I'd come to love this man and realized that somehow if countries keep closing their doors, 145, 150 countries have signed the Refugee Convention, yet here's a refugee who can't get in. If that keeps happening everywhere, then there's nowhere in the world for someone to go. 80% of refugees are in the global south now. That's where we have to work for them, but also we have to help somehow find a way to bring a greater equality so that people like this can live with freedom and justice. But that drives me. That memory of such a man continues to drive me, and it gives us motivation to find a better solution for such people.
My thanks there to Father Mark Raper, president of the Jesuit Conference of the Asia-Pacific region and former international director of the Jesuit Refugee Service. Meeting God in Friend and Stranger is the name of a comprehensive document about interfaith relations issued by the Catholic bishops of England and Wales in April 2010. It's a lengthy publication setting out the principles of Catholic teaching, plus some interesting practical examples of where interfaith activities are working best in parishes and dioceses around the country.
It's an excellent document, a very straightforward, easy-to-read document, which is still very complex, so it manages not to sacrifice any of the complex theological context and to still remain readable and accessible.
Katharina Muller is secretary for the Interreligious Relations Committee of the Bishops' Conference.
It's called Meeting God in Friend and Stranger, and it's available for download from our website. It's available from Christian bookshops, from the Catholic Truth Society, and I can very much recommend it. It's written very much with everybody in mind, very much with the option for everyone to study it and learn from the document. And it urges Catholics to enter into interreligious dialogue. And I think that's a very important point to make.
Do you think it has been received in a positive way by people? What reactions have you had so far?
I think it's been received in a very positive manner indeed, and not only by Catholics. I think it's very good for Catholics to have all teaching on interreligious dialogue in one place and to be able to use that in dialogue as well, to say, look, this is our official position. We're not doing this as a hobby, you know, or because we're the funny people who it is important to, but this is the official church line. This is important to all of us. Our bishops are urging us to do that. And also my ecumenical contact, and in fact contacts from other religions. Now obviously it's a document that is aimed at Catholics, so it's not a document that speaks to these contacts so much, but it's been very well received indeed, and I think it inspires other churches and other religions to also make their own position clearer, to come up with similar documents, similar statements, and I think that's a very positive thing actually.
You're right that in the past it was sometimes seen to be very in favour of interfaith dialogue, was sometimes seen as a rather sort of lefty, trendy thing to do, wasn't it? A rather liberal position,
yes,
by those who weren't able to defend perhaps the truths of their own faith.
Very much so, yes. And I think it's very important that the document makes a point that, no, this is not new teaching. This is just a new compilation of teaching that has always been around, and it's always been important to have that dialogue. But this is just a new, just to get it out there again, and to have it all in one place, which I think is very helpful. And I think really, if we take our belief seriously, that we are a church in constant dialogue with our God and that we have a God who's entered into that very costly dialogue, then if we want to take our own belief seriously, we can not afford not to enter into dialogue with others as well.
As you know, many parish priests will say, yes, that's fine, we get on perfectly nicely with our Jewish and Muslim neighbours, but we're far too busy as it is without embarking on any new initiatives to support this work.
Well, and I'm very aware that people are incredibly busy and that priests are busy and lay people have very busy lives. But I think that dialogue is something that can be shared very easily. And when I'm talking about dialogue, I'm talking about the wider definition that the document also has. So it's not just sitting down together and discussing the finer theological points. You know, it's as easy as having a chat with a Muslim neighbour or extending good wishes to a Jewish friend at a Jewish festival. Or, you know, indeed to share a meal, maybe a Christmas dinner with a family who is not Christian. And that sort of everyday contact can help make excellent progress with dialogue between the religions. So it's not something that should be left to experts. And indeed, the document says that lay people are often very well placed, actually, to enter into that dialogue. So it stresses that responsibility of lay people who are in the world, who have colleagues and friends and neighbours of different faiths, to actually enter into that dialogue.
Do you have any best practice stories, any areas where you really have seen extraordinary results from just this, as you say, very straightforward type of dialogue of daily life?
Well, I think there are a lot of touching stories out there, actually. Just very recently, one of my diocesan coordinators, there's an interreligious coordinator in every diocese, has got Muslim and Catholic women together, and they've shared their stories of praying with the rosary and with the Muslim prayer beads, and it was a very warm, very touching occasion. Also, I know of a Catholic and a Jewish lady, again a coordinator, who struck up a very fast friendship by interreligious dialogue. And I think it's these things that might look fairly small, but that really make a difference to communities and to how people feel about each other, really.
Are you suggesting that women may be leading the way in this field or not?
Well, I think women are still often the people who pick children up from the school gate and, you know, the family managers to an extent. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing, and I think men are coming into that field as well, but I think at the moment we very much have women as the centre of family still, and you know, they're arranging the play dates for the children and they're picking the children up from school, and they're probably the ones who remember the neighbours' birthdays, you know, and they probably remember the neighbours' festivals as well, you know. So, yeah, I think women are doing fairly well in that field, yeah.
Thanks there to Katharina Muller, Secretary for the Interreligious Relations Committee of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, if you can, for another edition of our feature programme. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.